Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello, welcome to True Hoop with me, Gerard Hector, and Henry Abbott. How are you, sir?
Good, thank you. Well, actually, not good. I'm dying over here. I got some sort of cold cough thing. The only reason I'm joining you in like a cold sweat is the miracle of pharmaceuticals. I'm just taking like every over-the-counter thing at once. I'll probably pass out about halfway through this. So yeah, I can't say I'm doing great.
And joining us is the author of the newly released book, Trash Talk. The only book about destroying your rivals that isn't totally garbage. Rafi Cohen. How are you, Rafi?
I'm doing better than Henry, although, you know, my kids have been, a kind of cesspool of germs and illness for the last month, too. So I totally relate and empathize with the pharmaceuticals.
See? Yeah. Mm-hmm. See, what you two go through is reason number 9,085,000 to not.
Oh, don't
have
go with right? The it's terrible. Like, we already had them, Gerard. Like, we're stuck. Like, I did though.
There's no turning back.
There's no turning back. It's actually against the law. Yeah, you can't. You can't. Yeah. When my wife was on the school board years, like when we were all in lockdown, one of her co-board members was a pharmacy, was like worked in pharmacy, and she was saying basically we're gonna have in a couple of years where like all of the germs that we're not being exposed to now like will come rushing back. And I was like, yeah, it feels like this is what's happening now. There's just like
just the rough times out here in these streets. But Rafi, thank you for joining us. This book is exciting. First of all, Trash Talk, if you're a sports fan, basketball fan like we are on this podcast, of course, I mean, Trash Talk is just emblematic to the game. It's also emblematic to life, and that's where I kind of want to start. And this quote just really kind of hit me in the face right away. The man who first flung a word of abuse at his enemy instead of a spear was the founder of civilization. And I was like, yeah. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly can't take credit for that quote, but I did, choose to include it. It was, a quote that comes from, I believe it's John Hewlings Jackson, and it was then sort of used by Freud at one point. But I think, right, the idea that we can channel our competitive nature, abuse into sort of verbal warfare, into gamesmanship, as opposed to just, you know, physical abuse that escalates quickly into violence and warfare, is the idea that we can learn to actually cooperate and create, you know, social collectives. And, you know, from there, we, you know, there's an argument that human language actually evolved from gossip, because it was the ability to, I mean, and I would argue that gossip is not trash talk. It doesn't totally qualify, but it is talking shit in one form or another. But that ability to talk, you know, talking shit about one another created this sort of mechanism for social shaming, which then allowed, you know, incentivized cooperation, and, you know, civilization is born. So yeah, I think we're really indebted to talking shit.
So wait, this whole idea that things that you learned when you were young, sticks and stones will break my bones, or words will never hurt me? Not really true. Words kind of do hurt.
Words do hurt. Actually, words are physically painful in the same way that physical violence is. That's true. Although we shouldn't throw that saying out altogether though, because I think it does come in handy, you know, when you are on the court and Gary Payton's coming at your head.
This is a basketball podcast, and in basketball, it seems like trash talk is like this invention of like 1980 or something. But man, your book, I mean, just like chapter one really had me like Okay, I'm going to read some. Unless you want to read it, but like, David to Goliath, I will fling you down and cut off your head. Or Agamemnon, you pansy archers, you are a disgrace to Greece. Or, of course, the greatest line is this renegade Roman poet Catullus, who called someone softer than a baby bunny's fur with, quote, a dusty cobweb dick. So it goes back a little ways, is the point.
Yeah, Catullus is my personal favorite. That he also threatened to quote dick his rivals in the face. So there's, we think that we're in this age of crassness and vulgarity, and all you have to do is read the invective poetries of ancient Rome and Greece and realize that we've always had it in us. But that stuff is, I also thought was so much fun. And I was trying, doing some of that historical arc of trash talk, I'm trying not to be overly academic or dense. I don't want to lose people before we get started. But I do think, two things. One, I think I'm like, your reaction is so amazing to me because that's exactly the same reaction that I had, which is just, holy crap, I can't believe what these guys are saying to each other. And it works. But two, I also think it is important that we don't think about trash talk as being this modern invention, this thing that popped up out of nowhere, but to try and, place it, historically, culturally, as this kind of behavioral phenomenon, this sort of, if we're going to call it a phenomenon, but this kind of mode of human communication that has existed throughout time and across culture and really is like the language of competition. It is how we talk to one another when we're competing.
Yeah. And talking about how old it is, our oldest sport in this country, baseball, that goes way back, They have these things called holler guys, And like, that's just, but when, if I'm assuming, Henry, did you play baseball growing up? I know you basketball.
No. Hey,
baseball?
Okay. No, I had but English parents in Oregon.
I was saying English, you probably didn't. Yeah. if you did play baseball, that was the thing, Even in when you were super young playing T-ball, Little League, all that stuff, you're just like, whoo, and you don't even know where it came from. You just started doing it because everybody else was doing it. It's bizarre.
You don't even think about it. And that stuff doesn't get exceptionalized in the same way because it's just so ingrained into the way we compete. You're saying, hey, batter, batter. It's like you are literally talking trash to a 9-year-old right now. who thought that was a good idea? Why do we need to up the stakes for little Timmy when he's 0 for his last 16? And it's just... But it truly is in baseball. Baseball was called bench jockeying because so much of it came, literally from the dugout and the bench. But it was, it's the idea of causing distraction, of getting someone, to focus on something other than the task at hand, or to otherwise become upset or, feel the pressure of the moment. All the same applications, of trash talk that we can find on the basketball court. You can find basically anywhere else, including baseball.
Well, I love that you said that, So that whole idea of getting people to do something different. In the book, you have a sports psychologist talk about, when trash talk happens, there's a physical state that happens within you, And it's basically the same, Whether it's the challenge state, Or the, what's the other one, challenge state versus threat. The threat state, And the physical reaction is the same. Heart rate beating fast, all the things. But how you view your heart rate beating fast, the sweat or whatever, determines what is probably going to happen next, So if you're confident in your ability and you're like, okay, you're locked in, I'm ready to roll. If you're not confident in your ability, shit, I'm going to miss this shot, whatever. Gary Payton's now in your head, right? It's war within yourself. And that's what the best trash talkers often say. If I'm already in your head and you're doing that thing and you're in the threat state, winner, win me, I win.
Yeah, right. And so this goes back to there's a model in sports psychology called the individual zones of optimal functioning. And not to get
that's what I was going to bring up.
Let's get into it.
So basically, the idea is previously there was this idea in sports psychology that what you wanted in terms of anxiety was. It sort of like a moderate level of anxiety. The law was the Yerkes-Dodson law, which was saying it's an inverted U curve. And it was saying, you don't want to have too little anxiety. You don't want to have too much anxiety. You want you know, as I said in the book, you want the Goldilocks of anxiety, like just right. And that's just not true, according to the Isov model, which states that each individual will have their own optimal state of anxiety for peak performance. And so for some people, that could be so much. And to define what we mean by anxiety here, it's literally, it is stress in your body. It's like parasympathetic stress. Mm-hmm. It's, racing heartbeat. Mm-hmm. It could be cognitive anxiety, but it's all these things that are happening in your brain and body. That is stress. That is anxiety. And for some people, I mean, the easiest example to give is Kevin Garnett, because it's so like visible that like he wanted to be, you know, a tightly coiled, you know, just ball of energy and nerves. Like that's where he needed to be. He needed to have an elevated state of anxiety, you know, to be at his best. Whereas, Tim Duncan, his, you know, infamous and stoic rival, needed to be more sort of like outwardly calm, you know, needed to probably have a sort of calmer mental state, which isn't to say that like his heart is not beating. Right. I mean, like he is running up and down the court competing in an NBA basketball game. But there's a certain level of arousal that, you know, at which you'll perform at your best. And, you know, and you need a certain amount of arousal to perform at your best. You can imagine if you have no arousal, no anxiety in your body, you're literally like a lump of silly putty right on the court. Like you're not going to perform. Like stress is not bad, you know, despite what we might think culturally. But when you go above like your sort of upper threshold for, you know, your peak performance state, there is a dramatic decline in performance. And what happens is, well, if you're really overwhelmed by stress, what happens is that you can enter fight, flight, or freeze. You have a threat response, right? This is a primal, you know, it is coded into our brain and our DNA. You know, there's a hormone cascade, and we will, you know, you will respond as if you are being attacked by a predator on the savannah. Like that is how our body will respond. But, you know, to your initial question about challenge versus threat states, is that we have a role to play in the way that we conceptualize the anxiety and the arousal that we face, right? So as you said, heart rate goes up, you know, pulse is beating, sweaty palms. You know, how do we appraise that stress? How do we think about the demands of the situation? Again, you enter, you know, fight, flight, you know, freeze when you believe you do not have the resources to meet the demands of the situation. You know, for the most part, you become, you know, you are overwhelmed by stress. But if you can reappraise the situation, your stress, and say, no, like my sweaty palms and my heart beating fast are an indication that I'm excited to take on this challenge, that I'm ready, because it's literally the same things that are happening in your body
for great performance. Like that also.
Yes, that's exactly. That's literally what's happening, right? Before you sit down for a final exam, right? Mm-hmm. If you have stress, anxiety, and this stuff is, transcends sports. It's, you know, it is like, you know, a musician going on stage, a performer before mm-hmm. a Broadway play, you know, literally just going to take a test. Like all of these are performance situations, you know, so this stuff is, you know, this can be applied well beyond, you know, the playing field. But that kind of that appraisal of saying, of telling yourself, I have the resources to meet these demands, will put you either into a challenge state or a threat state. And when you're in a challenge state, different things happen within your body, right? Your pulmonary vasculature expands, whereas in a threat state, it constricts. And what happens is that means is that this hard pumping blood goes out to your limbs. So you're ready to take action. You're ready, you know, you're ready to perform. Whereas in a threat state, when the vasculature constricts, it sends all the blood back to your internal organs because you're literally preparing for damage. Like you're expecting a lion to
rip your jugular.
Yeah. And you want to like save your own life, you know, but guess what? That's not great when you're like, you know, you're confronting a full court press and you
came seven of the finals. Not great.
Not great. And you know, in reality, it's rare that, you know, an elite athlete would enter into like a full-on threat state, you know, and you know, because they've encountered these kinds of anxieties before. They've encountered these kinds of challenges and they understand how to how to face them. But even small changes, right, within the Eyes-Off model, like let's say this is like arbitrary. These numbers don't mean anything, but like I think it helps to understand it. Like let's say you're a 7 out of 10, right? And somebody can get under your skin just enough to like get you to a 7.2, right? They're not getting you to an 8.5 where you're going to enter fight, flight, or freeze. But that just moving you that much could affect your attention, for example. Right, that could have attentional, consequences. And if your attention becomes off task, you know, again, at the elite levels of sport, we're talking about marginal differences making the difference between winning and losing. And if your attention, if your focus becomes slightly off from what it should be because you're out of your optimal zone of functioning, like maybe you're going to miss that guy who's making the backdoor cut, when you have an instant to make that decision. And so there's a lot that can happen, and it doesn't have to be the extreme where you would say like, oh, that guy choked. Like that guy has the yips. That guy can't shoot a free throw at all. And look, I would argue that Ben Simmons, was confronting. Was a confronting fight, flight, or freeze. Like he was in a true threat state, like was afraid of what was going to happen. And that might be an extreme case. I'm sort of going on a little bit of a tangent here, but since we went there, I would argue you saw the same thing from Giannis in the playoffs last year when he didn't want to drive to the hoop because he didn't want to shoot free throws. Yeah. And he had shown us that he could do it, right? In the 2021 finals, he demonstrated extreme mental toughness by not caring what anybody thought, by not caring if he missed a foul, a foul shot, by making the right decision in spite of that pressure, in spite of, possible distractions like crowds counting up and in so doing sort of like adding to the pressure of that moment, trying to disrupt his routine, trying to distract him. But doing the right thing anyway, right? Mental toughness in some ways can be defined as, making the right decision, doing the right thing, responding in the appropriate way in spite of any perceived pressures or possible distractions. So he showed us he could do it. But at the same time, there was clearly something in him that was afraid. He was responding out of fear in some sort of threat state. I'd say even in the finals the year before, Draymond Green, when he didn't want to shoot in the finals, like, am I calling Draymond Green mentally weak? No. Like, I would never dare.
Let's get him on the show.
But can you display mentally weak behavior in a given moment, in a given game? Absolutely.
It seems like your Ben Simmons thing really like made me think about like, there are all kinds of mistakes in basketball. Like, there's mistakes every play, right? But this particular brand of mistake is like a no-no, right? It's socially a no-no. The whole stadium knows you're not supposed to appear weak or scared, right? It's like and it feels to me like it's this brand of mistake. You can just like, Steph Curry can just miss a three and you can lose a game. It happens all the time, right? But everyone's like, that just happens, right?
Right.
But if you do what Ben Simmons did, like the whole world's like, this is out of the question. You have been cowed, right? Like you are like whatever. There's something about that that's like deeper and more socially impactful.
Yeah. And right. And to the point of like, failure's part of the game, right? In any sport, right? We know that in baseball, the famous saying, right, is, you fail 70% of the time and you're a Hall of Fame.
Right.
Steph Curry is going to miss threes. Reggie Miller is going to miss last minute shots. Michael Jordan's going to miss, last second shots. Like, failure is part of the game. Part of what being mentally tough is doing the right thing in spite of the possibility of failure. But when you become afraid of failure, when you become afraid of how you're going to look, when you become afraid of other people's perceptions of you as a result of that failure, you're not performing in the way that like your team is demanding of you, that the game is demanding of you. So like, would it have been better if Ben Simmons just missed shots and Giannis just missed free throws? Yeah, because they're like, that's a failure that we're kind of accustomed to seeing. And mental, I don't mean to harp on mental toughness, but like mental toughness is the answer to trash talk. Like, it is literally the response to trash talk for a lot of different reasons, which we can get into. But it's like, because you are comfortable with failure as long as you're responding and behaving in the appropriate way as the game demands. And that kind of like sitting under the basket and giving up an open layup and passing it out is such a flagrant admission that you are scared in that moment. Whereas Steph Curry missing is the exact opposite. He's saying, I'm not scared of anything. I am not afraid to miss. And that, so even though they're both types of failures, the character of that failure couldn't be different. Couldn't be more different.
Mm-hmm. Oh no, this is all like, I'm loving this. Okay. So we're talking about like trash talk, right? It's the name of your book. And it's this, you do a very good job of bringing up the racial component of this and how, you know, when sports writers started talking about it, right? And sports writers, particularly in the early 80s, were mostly white people, right?
Yeah.
Right. And it was this sort of like introduction of black culture and black, you know, being to white people, which is like, and Henry, we talked about this off air, like, when you hear the, I don't really know what that means. It's like, it's fine. Just keep watching. Like, you know, you don't even know what it means. Keep watching.
You'll survive.
But, yeah. And this is what it was, right? It was just, and it had this negative connotation, right? You bring it back to, oh, that's the street ballization of the game coming in. That's this, then it's that. But as you so eloquently pointed out early in your book, that's not a black person thing. That's a human thing. Like, we've been doing this since the beginning of time, right? And so now when we get to this point about, you know, opening up the eyes of white fans or the white media to this, what I find particularly interesting is how someone grows up, a black person in culture, bringing that to the mainstream. So I think of the dozens, right? Which, and that's not what it was called when I was a kid, but you go to school and you'd be at the lunch table and you knew.
What did y'all call it? Because it does have so many names.
I mean, it was just like dissing your friends, whatever. That's a
good. Right, yeah.
But I mean, not only did you have to be like thick-skinned, you had to be quick with the like everything had to be rapid fire. And if you could not stand the heat of that pressure, you wouldn't go to lunch that day because this is not a place for me to be. Yeah. And you just learn how to, you know, and that's sort of like your muscle memory, right? So you're doing that so often a time. By the time you get to high school, college, pros, I've been rehearsed in this a million times. I'm good. Totally. I know where the comebacks are.
Totally. I mean, the dozens is, which should we define that for people or do you feel like
that? Go ahead. Yeah, sure.
Well, so the dozens is an insult game endemic to, you know, black American communities, you know, sort of traded insults, most commonly sort of thought of as like your mama jokes, mm-hmm. right? It goes by many names, as you you mentioned. And the dozens is literally, you know, has literally served as a kind of like linguistic and psychological training for black folks in the United States. And in terms of this, the psychological aspect of it, I think Gary Payton is interesting to mention here mm-hmm. because someone who grew up, you know, obviously talking shit like outside of the basketball, you know, outside of the game of basketball, but very much talking shit on the court as well, right? So it's like this muscle has been strengthened over years of competition where the verbal game and the mental game, because they're, you know, inextricable from one another, is part of how he competes. It's part of what he brings to the table as a player. And so when you think about then him joining the NBA in the early 1990s, and yeah, so like 1993 is seen as like the year of trash talk. It's when it really, like the term was basically coined in the early 1980s, which obviously isn't to say that trash talk didn't exist before them, but trash talk as a term did not exist, which allowed us to kind of, you know, phenomenize it and exceptionalize mm-hmm. it in this way. We have all these trend stories in the early 1990s. Like, what's going on? What is all this? You know, we start to see it. We start to see this, like, again, trash talk as the language of competition is something that has existed throughout time and culture. But modern American trash talk, as we think about it, is influenced and inflected by the language of Black America. because it comes out of traditions like the Dozens and hip hop, mm-hmm. which was also,
battle rap.
Sort of evolving. 100%. Like, that's literally what, yes. what we're talking about here. Right. And so there's a couple of things. One is, so at its core, trash talk is a kind of test on the court, or anywhere really. It is it is the presentation of a challenge, and you're sort of asking your competitor, how are you going to respond to this? Like, can you handle the test that I'm giving you? And sometimes the response might be like, I don't have to engage with you. And like, if you like, that's Tim Duncan, mm-hmm. that's John Stockton, that's Shane Battier, and understanding that I need to focus on my own performance and the ways that like I can be at my best. That is a response. Like, it's not actually ignoring. Sort of like dismissing and not engaging is not the same thing as like, pretending it's not there. It's acknowledging and dismissing. But you are testing someone's ability, their mental skills, right? Their mental skills to focus on the game at hand, to self-regulate and stay in their own zones of optimal functioning. To refocus if they do become distracted, like it is a mental test of your opponent. And that is what Gary Payton is doing. That's literally what he's doing. And if we want to say that this is not part of competition, then we should ask ourselves, why are we saying this is not part of competition? Are we saying it's not part of competition because we recognize it as some kind of like deviant, behavior that has sort of like immoral components to it? And if we're saying that, why are we saying that? At the time in the 1990s, we were saying it because we saw it as a kind of exotic behavior because it came out of Black traditions. Like, it was something that needed to be controlled on the court. It was something that would be viewed as threatening to white audiences. And when we say threatening, we mean like threatening the viewership. Like, I'm scared of this, right? Like, this is not something this makes me uncomfortable. Like, which is obviously, the story of
the story of white people in America as it relates to Black people.
Sorry.
In general, right? So it's like trash talk is obviously just like yet another venue where that will happen. But when we start to then regulate the behavior or police the behavior of players on the court, we're literally stripping them of parts of their game that they've spent their entire lives developing. And to your point, right, that like having spent middle school, high school, and probably even some early years for some folks too, just like learning to talk and take shit, mm-hmm. like you're also learning to self-regulate. Like Gary Payton could get himself, I think Gary Payton probably had a higher eyes off than most people, maybe not higher than Kevin Garnett, but I think higher than a lot of the people he competed against. But what I found really interesting is I came across all of these stories of how Gary Payton could be so worked up. And this was true both like in his personal life, like hanging out with friends, he'd get mad at someone and be going nuts on them in his Gary Payton way or do it on the court. And then you'd hear these stories about how he could like bring himself down in an instant, right? So it's just like, and that's what, when we talk about some of the mental skills training that guys need to do to try to like, for example, you're a little bit over aroused, or you're getting to a free throw line because you're going to the free throw line because eyes off is not like set in stone, right? Like depending on the task at hand, depending on the game you're playing, there's a million conditions that can be placed on what your peak performance state will be. So driving to the lane, into traffic is very different than where you need to be to make an inbounds pass or shoot a free throw. So you're all worked up because you just got fouled driving to the hoop. And now you need to bring yourself down, right? In an instant, in a single breath, you need to bring yourself down. Like, that's what someone like Gary Payton knew how to do. And he knew how to do it. I mean, I don't know. I did talk to Gary Payton, but like, I don't know that like he would say like, yes, I was doing mental skills training.
Right.
But he would absolutely say that he was playing mental games. And I think the fact that he demonstrated so much, ability to self-regulate, yes, he got technical fouls, but he also, some of that I think we can chalk up to the culture clash of trash talk, in the early to mid 90s, mm-hmm. some of which we can also chalk up to the fact that like he just needed to be at a pretty high level mm-hmm. to compete. And also some of which we can chalk up to the fact that he told me that he would go into games occasionally and tell a referee, hey, listen, I'm going to get on you tonight. I want you to give me a technical foul. And he would do it because he knew that like he wasn't up for the game. Right. In the same way that people can use trash talk, in fact, to self-motivate. Right. And he would use trash talk because he wanted you to either talk trash to him or he needed some sort of tension, some kind of emotional tension. And so if he gets on the ref teching him is like almost a form of trash talk in that way. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. So he would tell him, like, I'm going to get on your ass. And when I do, give me a technical foul. Although Bennett Salvador told me, I asked him if that was true, and he said, well, most of the time he didn't have to ask, but it did happen. And Kevin Garnett is another guy who a former ref, Joe Forte, told me. He's like, I thought, Kevin Garnett was never out of control, like, and which is shocking to hear, right?
This guy barked like a dog.
He barked like a dog. He punched a hole in the wall while watching a reality television show. This guy seems nuts, but he said he was one of those guys you could count on to go to in those moments when tensions were rising to say, hey, can you rein in your teammates? Hey, can you bring things down a notch? And he was always one of those guys who could do exactly that. So like to a certain extent, I think he allowed himself to get to those levels. The opposite, I think, would be someone like, to around that time or a little further, is John Starks. I'm a Knicks fan. I grew up a Knicks fan in the 90s. John Starks was my favorite player. And I was really excited, to get a chance to interview him. And the one question I wanted to ask him, but couldn't bring myself to, although our conversation kind of revolved around this topic in general, was, why were you so mentally weak? Like, I wanted to ask my hero.
He's not coming over to dinner, Rafi.
No, so I didn't ask. I couldn't bring myself to ask my hero why he was mentally weak. However, we had a conversation about all these moments of mental weakness, right? Him versus Reggie, him losing his temper on the court, him snapping in one form or another. And the thing that he said was that he recognized his emotions were kind of like both his weakness and his superpower, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a guy who was never going to make it, who was bagging groceries when he was 20 years old, who was cut, wasn't drafted, was cut by, the Warriors when he signed with them, bounced around,
was in the CBA.
He was in another, I forget what the name of the other league, but and eventually caught on with the Knicks, which was most likely his last legitimate chance to ever play. And a quirk of history is that he actually would have been cut if he didn't get injured in practice. Like that very day, trying to dunk on Patrick Ewing, he got knocked to the floor and got hurt. And there was a rule forbidding players from being cut when they were injured. That's the only reason he had a career.
That's why I always dunk on Patrick Ewing too. Same reason.
So this is a guy who's out with something to prove, who plays with this almost like maniacal need to, to be on edge, really. And so that's what he talked about, is that he spent his college days, his early career, he would literally watch film of himself on the court, like after games, which is not like an insane thing to do, right? But he would do it not to like see, if he made the right cuts or, his shooting form. He watched to literally monitor his own behavior, to see how he was like self-regulating, to see when he was getting out of control. And he would try to remind himself then how to better keep himself in control going forward. He would say things to himself like, just stay calm, keep it together. When you saw him on the bench sometimes with a towel over his head, that's literally what he was saying to himself. But there were some games when he, wasn't feeling it or just, wasn't playing well, whatever, that he would just say to himself, you know what? Fuck it. like I'm not going to try to regulate myself at all because I need to be like even more out of, I need to be on, like so far on the edge that like, yeah, some like I might lose control. and he almost embraced it. So it's almost, so I'd almost say that like he displayed, you know, sorts of mentally weak behaviors, but I think in some ways his decision process in getting there, like, demonstrated a level of self-awareness that actually, you know, reflects a kind of mental strength too. So, you know, so I come around on, you know, I'm glad I didn't ask exactly that.
Rafi, before we were prepping for the show, I was like, I might end up going down this rabbit hole of herding culture, but here we are. I can't help myself. Do you know anything about what I'm talking about here?
I'm not sure. Tell me about it.
Okay. So I think it's in this book called The Hour Between Dog and Wolf, which is an amazing book. We could talk more about that. But I think it's in there. Basically, like, people in herding culture, all of your assets that your family depends on are so stealable, right? Like, if you're a farmer, then they have to take your land, which is, you're pretty sure that's not going to happen. But if you're a herder, then you walk around in the middle of nowhere, maybe a child, and the next person with a gun or a weapon can just take everything your family owns. So in herding cultures, there's a tremendous merit in acting crazy. Like, mm-hmm. you just talk really big and really wild. And so that back in the bar, they'll be like, man, watch out for, like, you know, that Schneider kid. He's a little wild, right? But you can literally, like, they do these studies where they'll have, like, little confrontational moments happen in, like, the college lab where they're testing this. And they'll have, like, someone bump into you and, like, grumble, like, you know, asshole, like, on the way to take the test. And then if you're genetically from herding culture, you're going to take that test and, like, make violent answers. Like, whereas if you're not, oh, you know, anecdote about, like, someone hitting on your girlfriend or whatever, and, like, and you're like, I will go and kill that person. But if you're not from herding culture, you'd be like, it's just a night at the bar. Like, these things happen. Right. And your John Stark story there struck me as like, oh, he's got a delicate situation, right? Like, he doesn't feel like he belongs there. He doesn't feel like he's mandated to be in the NBA. He acting a little crazy. You might scare some people off from his assets, right? Does that make sense?
It makes total sense. And acting crazy is a terrific way to talk trash. Right? We can go back. Draymond we can Green. Look at Muhammad Ali against Sonny Liston. Mm-hmm. Like, that's literally what he was doing in the morning of the weigh-in, before their first heavyweight bout. He was spouting off. He was yelling. He came in yelling and screaming and, you know, saying, somebody's going to die at ringside tonight from shock. And just like, you know, you've got no chance, chump, like, and all this stuff. And was just acting truly like a maniac. And it wasn't just that, you know, this was like part of the drumbeat of, like, you know, denigration and confrontation that had sort of led to that fight in the first place. But this was also highly choreographed, you know, according to the biographer of Bundini Brown, that they actually spent time almost like professional wrestlers preparing for, like, he's going to charge at Liston. And, like, there was Bundini and Sugar Ray Robinson literally holding him back. But, like, they practiced this. They practiced it in the gym. And what Bundini had told Muhammad Ali was, the only thing that scares a tough guy is a crazy guy, right? Ooh. That's like, you're going to be just, like, a little bit more careful around this person. Maybe not attack as aggressively. Maybe just, like, you know, if it throws you off even that millisecond, if it throws your focus off even a tiny bit, if you down-regulate even a little bit, all of these things have major impacts on performance when we're talking about, you know, fractional changes having huge implication for final outcomes. Since we're talking about craziness, I this is not basketball again, but Shet Messing. Are you familiar with a former soccer player named Shet Messing?
Mm-mm.
Okay. Neither was I. Yeah. So he was a goalkeeper for the 1972 U.S. Olympic team. He went on.
That would be why I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, he played.
That was a little snobby, John. Just a little.
Which, by the way, was the first time the U.S. men's team made the Olympics in the qualifying era. Okay. So it was, you know, a notable team.
Not to draw.
He went on and played for.
Yeah.
Still not. Still getting nothing from Gerard.
You don't play in Champions League? I don't know you.
He never did. But maybe you'll give some respect to the fact that he played for the New York Cosmos, because he was
a little bit of that.
Because he was teammates with Pele, Franz Beckenbauer, guys like that.
I know those dudes.
Yeah. So he what he would do is he knew that there was this kind of there was this stigma around goalies in soccer for being a little bit touched, for being a little bit crazy, right? The idea was that if you were going to play goalkeeper, you had to be a little bit nuts to play this position. So he would use that kind of stereotype to his advantage. Well, so he would do little things like on corner kicks, he would like walk around almost in a daze and just be like, where am I? What's going on? Like as if he was like genuinely lost. Other times he would mumble to himself, like, you know, quiet, violent things. And then he would go up to someone, this is like on a corner kick, and grab them earnestly, stare them in the face and say, I'm sorry for anything that I do. I'm off my medication.
That's brilliant.
I love it.
And he just knew, like, you just act a little bit nuts and they're going to be like, you know, maybe I'm not going to go for that header. Maybe I'm just going to like pull back a little bit. And actually, so we said that the 1972 team, right, was the first U.S. men's team to make the Olympics in the qualifying era. We can credit that accomplishment to Shep Messing's trash talk of being a crazy person.
Mm.
So in the early qualifying rounds, there was a shootout. It was in Jamaica. If memory serves, it was a game against Ecuador. They already had two draws, so this was, they were having like a third match on neutral ground. Each team was on track, you know, to making all five of their shots. And Shep says to himself, well, this is going to come down to me, so fuck it. Let's get nuts. And literally what he does, and Shep, to picture him at this time, you know, so 1972, don't think like professional athlete.
Right.
Think like AC/DC, Black Sabbath.
Okay.
Like, right? This is a guy with like long, flowing, curly hair, mustache. You know, this is pure 1970s.
Yeah.
Yep. Takes off his shirt, starts swinging it around his head, and charges right at the guy, Mario Castro. It's just screaming and cursing. He gets up to him. The ref gives him a yellow card.
Perfect. Yeah.
And he says, he's like, you know, get back there. And he says to Mario Castro, he goes like, now don't miss. And goes back to the box. Castro takes a shot and shoots it so high above the crossbar that Shep doesn't even have to move. Mm-hmm. Like, he was just like, he said the look on Castro's face was like he was scared stiff.
Like, why did so he bother putting his shirt back on? He could have just left
it off. You know what? It's a great – he should have maybe never put a shirt back on.
No, this makes so much sense. This was Argentina's goalie in the World Cup. It just concluded, right? I mean, Martinez.
Yes.
This is what he was doing, right, in the shootout, right?
Getting in
just
your head.
Like, getting in your head, acting like a legit crazy person. And you're like, meanwhile, you're thinking about, what the fuck is wrong with this guy? Instead of, fuck him, where's the corner that I'm shooting at, right? Like, but you're focused on this nut job.
You get someone to think about literally anything other than what they should be focusing on in the moment, and you're gaining an edge. Like, they might be able to, again, if they have the mental skills to acknowledge their own distraction and refocus and self-regulate back to where they should be, then that's the counter to it.
Mm-hmm.
But like, you know, be crazy. Great. Be complimentary. Like, say something nice to someone. And that is so unexpected. Being unexpected is really the thing that like cuts through, right? It like sort of makes someone pay attention in a way that they should. Cheryl Miller tells me that the best way, right, to get someone to screw up their shot was you just go up to them and say, wow, you're shooting really well today. Like the way you're bringing back your elbow and cocking your wrist.
Now you're all fucked up. You're thinking about everything else.
Well, because these things that are supposed to be, you know, automatized in your brain that you do without thinking, now you're thinking about them and you're investing cognitive effort in something that you shouldn't be focusing on. And you then that's when you really start to fuck up. My favorite be weird version of this comes from amateur high school wrestling. Is this guy? So like right when you know how they're sort of start, mm-hmm. they start like, you know, one on top of the other. He would whisper in his ear. He would say, "Do you moisturize?
You have
really soft skin."
It's over. Especially high school boys, like over at that point.
That's amazing. Well, it's like, okay, to me, I feel like there's like different categories. Like, one of them is like, we're both comfortable here. and like I'm showing you how comfortable I am here, right? Mm-hmm. A different category is like you might have rabies, right? Like this is the Ali thing, right? Where it's like you're so crazy, you might break all the rules of society, right? Like, because sports actually have a lot of taking care of each other, right? Like we kind of follow the rules and we kind of like move in ways that we try not to decimate each other, right? But basically, Ali and another examples are saying like, I don't know about today. Like today might be the day that those rules are out the window, right? That's like a different category.
Yeah. Well, I think the way to think about it is to think about the pathways by which trash talk can work sort of psychologically, right? So one of them is this kind of, you know, this pathway of like anxiety and stress, right? And, you know, potentially pushing someone into a threat state. And so I think acting crazy is a way to potentially do that, or, you know, to get them above or below. If you intimidate someone, if someone's feeling fear, you actually might downregulate. Like, and that could work, you know, in the same way that pushing someone beyond, like angering them to the point that they explode through the threshold could. Another one, though, is we said is attention and focus, right? And there's different types of attentional states, right? And the way this was explained to me, and I think it's like such a beautiful way to envision it, so I'll do it here, is that like you can think about attention as a kind of funnel, right? You could have a wide funnel or you could have a narrow funnel. And there's not one that's better than the other in terms of an attentional state. Like, you know, if you have a wide funnel, you have sort of like an open focus, you're taking in lots of information. Like you could think about like a quarterback in football who wants to read, you know, all the routes and the coverages and feel someone coming up on their blind side. Or I think probably like a point guard, right? Who you guys were talking about this last week, actually, about like the different sort of like demands on positions, mm-hmm. right? And as I was listening to that, I was thinking about like the different attentional states that might be required by position, mm-hmm. and how you can kind of use that to your advantage to talk shit potentially.
Let's explore that. Yeah,
that sounds very good. We can. But like, so a more narrow focus, right, is like you're not taking in as much information. You're very focused on something. When you have higher arousal, you have a more narrow focus. When you have lower arousal, you have a wider focus. And like neither one is better than the other inherently. It's all about like what is better for the task at hand. Again, like a point guard. So an example that was given to me by a former teammate of Isaiah Thomas's, the Hall of Famer, not Zeke. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And is that he was actually someone that you might want to talk trash to. And the reason was because he would respond out of pride. Pride is what a terrific way to go at somebody. His focus would narrow, right? And then he would be going one-on-one and trying to prove a point instead of trying to facilitate for his teammates, maybe missing an open guy into the basket or, you know, someone in the corner.
I've done this, people. Yep, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. When you, but like, because you become so, yep. You become so single-minded, yeah. Right? That like you're literally, you can imagine it. You're literally not taking in all the information that you should.
And even better if like the person doing this, Tim, is like a role player. Because now he's obsessed. Like he's, it's like a stalemate, but they're taking the other team's all-star out of the mix. Right. Right?
Exactly. Like, totally. Great. Take the role player out. Who cares? Like your best player now is doing something else. Yeah.
Maybe we both get ejected. That'd be great.
Right. Well, think about Patrick Beverley versus Russell Westbrook, mm-hmm. right? That mm-hmm. it's like all of those battles. Westbrook is another guy who has suggested to me as someone you might want to talk trash to because.
For sure.
As Gilbert Arenas put it, it's like he becomes a Ferrari in traffic. Or Lamborghini in traffic, right? That it's just like, it's that same thing. And Westbrook, I think, has shown himself to be a prideful person. You know, are we saying that it's bad to like, you know, be proud of your accomplishments and want your kids to like, you know, look up to you? No, of course not. But do you remember when he was got so upset when everybody was calling him Westbrick, mm-hmm. right? Like 2 years ago? Mm-hmm. You're admitting a kind of sensitivity in that moment. You're saying like, by saying like, this is honor, you are dishonoring me. You're literally saying I'm going to respond out of pride and ego. And that is a way to get at somebody. Like somebody who's prideful, somebody who has ego, somebody who's insecure, somebody who's volatile, like John Starks, these are all things to go after, mm-hmm. right? Because it could push them. It could either change their focus, change their attentional state, or push them, you know, in or out of their zone of optimal functioning. Like that's exactly the guys you want to go after. And I do think the attentional state thing as it applies to position is interesting because I think a point guard in particular, right? If you could get somebody, you know, above their zone of functioning, or get them to sort of narrow their focus in that way that, like, you know, allegedly Isaiah Thomas did when somebody would start talking shit to him. Like, yeah, Isaiah might score some points, but he's pulling his whole team out of the game flow, mm-hmm. right? Like, the team is going to is not going to succeed in the same way as they would otherwise. Maybe they'll win the game, you know, because Isaiah Thomas is a Hall of Fame player and he's going to drop 40 on you. But, like, that's not what you want. And that's not ultimately, like, the best way to succeed.
Ravi, how do you parent this?
Oh, man. The way I parent trash talk, and I do.
You get, like, this big book to study. I want you to have all these comebacks ready.
Having a comeback could be valuable, but the thing is, it's learning the mental toughness. It's learning the sort of the response. It's learning the responses more than the actual, the shit talk itself. And again, that's more along the lines in my mind of the Tim Duncan, mm-hmm. The Shane Battier. It's understanding, and this is like an old sports psychology cliche, but is really true, and I think really helpful when confronted with trash talk, is, control the controllables, right? You can't control what someone else says to you, but you're in control of how you respond to it, right? And so that could be the case in terms of, like, how you respond emotionally, how you respond performatively. And the second thing that I would say is that, and this comes from, like, the sort of, like, Stoic philosophers, is, like, nobody can insult you without your own. This is like a tweak on the Eleanor Roosevelt quote. Nobody can insult you without your permission. Nobody can upset you without your permission. Like, you are kind of giving your consent when you become upset. You're making yourself upset. Like, you're choosing to react in that way. And I think understanding that we have agency over these things, over what upsets us, over what offends us, over, the emotions, like, literally the emotions we feel. And I don't get into the emotion literature in the book, but I actually spent a lot of time learning about, the constructionist model of emotions and how, like, we build emotions out of, like, more basic neural ingredients. And, some of the things that relate to that, or that contribute to that are things like our knowledge of emotion itself, like, impacts what we feel. But the point is that, like, we have agency in this. And so, like, to allow your emotions to take over completely, right? To feel like this was an analogy or metaphor that was given to me, that, like, your emotions are like wild horses on a carriage, and they're just, like, totally out of control and pulling you any direction, is not true and also unhelpful. But understanding that, because we can construct emotions, we can also deconstruct them, that we can be more in control of how we respond, controlling our own responses. We might start to get into some moral questions along these lines.
I don't see why there would be any moral questions.
but also, it's like, when we start talking about, like, what offends us, right? Do we have, like, are there certain things, where we have a moral imperative to respond in certain ways that contradicts competitive imperatives, right? That, like, you can think about, like, when, if somebody is saying something racist to Carmelo Anthony, like, there was an incident a couple years ago where he stopped a game and called someone out and had them removed from the game. It's like, bravo, right? But, like, there's not no right or wrong answer here. I mean, I think we could say there's a moral answer. Mm-hmm. But, like, are you potentially distracting yourself by allowing yourself to engage with what's being said? And is that a kind of competitive failure? I don't know. Whereas, like, if you ignore it completely or dismiss it completely and only focus on, self-regulation and what the task at hand, is that a kind of moral failure? And so I think there's a real tension with some of these things. And then, start talking about where to draw the line and how far is too far. But I think, regardless of where we might fall on that, I think understanding at least that there is this tension at play that should be sort of acknowledged and occasionally, discussed is important.
That's one of the most fascinating. I mean, the way they package the league now, right? Like, now and mostly forever, but especially since, like, Malice in the Palace, right? Is,
yeah,
like, these are just very jolly men and like plaid shirts, you know, and whatever, like
league fits.
Exactly. Yeah.
It just feels like, man, we are missing a lot there. Even David Stern, in my personal experience, was like a master of invective and trash talk, right?
Oh,
like,
my God. Yeah.
What did he say to Scott Skiles that time in the meeting, Henry?
Yeah. Like, we're missing almost everything that matters within the game when we, like, just screen this out of the game broadcast and, like, just strip it out into this, like everyone's just like your workplace, everyone's being very professional. It's like, no, man, that is completely
wrong. Well, we talked about this before you came on, Robbie. Like, you know, when you watch League Pass, you watch a bunch of games, there's so many cameras and mics around, you'll often pick up, like, oh, like, so-and-so trash talking to somebody else. But then, like, all of a sudden, it'll shift to the main broadcast guy, and, like, it gets, I'm like, this is probably what, I mean, it's what I want to hear.
Absolutely.
Like, put this on. It's not going to offend anybody's sensibilities. Like, because as you said, we've been doing this since the beginning of time. Like,
well, it shouldn't offend anybody's sensibilities, right? But that's one of the interesting things about, you know, like the ideas of trash talk and modernity and like how have things changed. It's like, in some ways, they haven't changed at all, right? But I think our exposure to it has, and I think technology is a big reason for that, right? Because of these microphones and cameras planted around the arenas, because of the sort of, you know, the media ecosystem that exists around it, right? The scale and speed at which information can travel and, you know, invective and incivility in particular. It's like these things do have, again, I'm not saying that like I'm against, you know, having, you know, creating the right form for trash talk to take place, but it is also worth considering the ways in which decontextualized incivility can have kind of like wider societal fallout, right? And the, I mean, this is probably actually a more important conversation for politics, frankly, than it is for athletics. So it's not, again, it's not to exceptionalize athletes in this way, but it is worth just considering that. Mm-hmm. You know, that context is important, right? Creating, you know, the magic circle around the game and what's permitted here versus what's permitted in regular life is something that is not necessarily the same. There is a kind of transformation that takes place. Like there's a reason that trash talk is the language of competition and not like the language of the DMV. Right,
you spent trash talking the DMV. Sometimes that DMV worker might get a little trash talking with you.
But like, okay, let's say you have the job of making high school wrestling popular on TV.
Yeah,
that's a tough job. Like, you must have that moisturizer line on mic.
100%.
Right? Absolutely. And frankly, yeah. You know, I talked to some folks within like the world of amateur wrestling who bemoaned the fact that they were so uptight and kind of patrician about like, you know, trash talk. And I think because it's like maybe they're responding to pro wrestling and this idea, which is like a different functionality of trash talk, right? This kind of like this self-promotion and hype around an event, which is equally important, right? Rivalry creation and marketing. Like there is actual business application for trash talk. There's a reason why, you know, Larry Bird versus...
What's the phrase? Know, talking him into the arena?
Talking them into the arena. Yeah, I love that phrase.
Well, it's why pro wrestling's so popular, right?
Right.
People fucking love pro wrestling because of all of that stuff.
Absolutely. And there's nothing wrong with that. It like it shows it's a way to invest the audience. It's a way to invest the performers themselves. Again, we talk about, or I talk about, you know, trash talk being a kind of test. It put in so doing, it inherently raises the stakes of competition, right? It puts more on the line because the question becomes, how are you going to respond and can you handle this? And when you publicize that kind of challenge, now we're all interested, right? Like you're more invested, your competitor's more invested, but we're collectively more invested too because you've endowed meaning to this event in a way that it wouldn't otherwise have. Like, it's existential. Literally, trash talk is existential. And we should not shy away from. There's nothing wrong with it. And I think amateur wrestling would do well to bring back some trash talk. Not even bring back, but bring it. I think baseball, I would make the case that baseball should bring back bench jockey, you know, for two reasons. One, because I think maybe it would make baseball more interesting. But also, I think there's a kind of thin-skinnedness that you can see within, you know, professional athletes and baseball players in particular, because they did not sit at the lunch table, you know, as a high schooler or middle schooler learning to give and take insult. And they're not confronting it on a daily basis. And so they've built up a sensitivity as opposed to a kind of, you know, inoculation to these kinds of challenges and bar, you know, that's what it is. It's challenge in the form of incivility. And that's amazing and hilarious and draws us in, you know?
Baseball players have built up such an insensitivity to it that when you hit a home run off of a pitcher and you stare too long at it, he will throw the baseball at your head next time because he's so upset. I'm like, really? This is what we're doing because you're so mad.
Yeah.
Right? You're a big baby. You gave him a home run. You're going to throw a baseball at someone's head.
Yeah. It's mental weakness. I mean, you are overly sensitive, and with that, and you're probably the type of person who can be distracted in one form or another. Like, you're giving that away, right? So then on the other side, how can you figure out a way to distract that person, right? How can, like, maybe it's not through trash talk, or maybe it's not through, like, specifically, like, you know, hollering from the bench. But I mean, these types of psychological profiles of athletes are things that can be, you know, leveraged against them if you actually understand them.
So you spend so much time going through this research, and meanwhile, Draymond Green's career is kind of playing out in an interesting new chapter. I just wonder kind of how you see all that.
Yeah. So Draymond Green, he's so interesting. I think he's a brilliant and beautiful trash talker in a lot of way, and in a lot of really noble ways, actually. Like, I think he's really secure in who he is. He embraces his own kind of, like, weaknesses and deficiencies for the most part, outside of, like, the Celtics finals. you know, but, like, he talks openly on podcasts about, like times he's cried to his mom and, like, these sorts of things that you would think, like, oh, I thought you would be so macho and prideful. But again, speaks to this ability of kind of, like, confronting and acknowledging one's own weaknesses so that they can't be weaponized against you. Understanding who you are is critical to mental toughness in that way. But I think beyond that, we also have to understand how Draymond uses trash talk. And I think that's where the eyes off model comes in, right? I think he's one of those guys that really needs to be at a high level, needs to be worked up into a frenzy. He's talked about how, you know, like a mid-January, February game, you know, in Minnesota, you know, and he wants to talk trash to the opponent. So they'll talk trash back to him because that, again, creates the drama. It endows meaning. You know, it's motivation is another pathway by which trash talk can work. So he's giving himself motivation as well as getting himself up to the sort of, you know, his peak performance state. But eyes off, in addition to having, you know, the sort of arousal component, also has emotional components. And Draymond, I think, understands his own peak performance state to be, you know, associated with anger. That's, you know, from the outside. That would be my, you know, along the lines of someone like Brian Cox in football, who what he would do was sort of like invent these elaborate nightmarish fantasies where the opposing team raped his wife or kidnapped his kids. And he would literally scream at them across the line of scrimmage, like, you raped my wife and kidnapped my kids. So he was getting He was a crazy person. he was using anger to get himself up to this level. And I think once you acknowledge and understand that, the question is then, is there another way to get there, you know, without necessarily using anger in that way or not? Because anger cuts both ways, right? You know, anger can get us there, but, you know, anger can also lead to impulsivity. It can lead to poor decision-making. And there are ways, there are mental skills you can use to literally regulate yourself to get there that don't involve the sort of indulgence of that kind of emotion, of what we can, might think of as negative emotion. And again, it's not that, like, you shouldn't have any anger. Maybe you need an aspect of it, but is there a way to become more in control of it so that, like, again, you're steering the horse carriage instead of the carriage just, like, riding off, you know, off course? Because I think when we start to then see some of these, like, outbursts, quote unquote, from Draymond, where, you know, he's, you know, trying to sell a foul but actually punching someone in the face, or, you know, kicking someone in the balls, or punching a teammate or whatever. Like, I think we can then understand that better if we understand the ways in which he understands his own peak performance state and how he uses trash talk as it relates to that. So I don't, like, it's not, I, this is armchair psychology. I don't want to say this is, you know, like, I know Draymond better than he or his teammates or coach or family or anyone knows him. But I think it would be really, really helpful to understand him as a trash talker, to then understand how that might inform some of his behavior And then the ways in which he might be able to use, you know, use the understanding of psychology and mental skills to get, you know, to still play at your best, but in a way that maybe you're in more in control.
Yeah. I mean, for him, right, it's that anger state is he's always up to and over that. That's how you get the best out of him. But
right.
when he can't control it and goes over the line is when it's problematic for all people involved. Right. right? And that's the double-edged sword of that, that he's not able to control seemingly.
Yeah. Right. And it's similar to, as you say it, right? It reminds me of John Starks, right? Is he allowing himself to go over that line? And is there a way to kind of stay on that line where you're more in control? And I don't know if there's anything that, like, everyone's sort of been hinting at, like, outside stuff with Draymond and, like, bigger. Right. So I don't want to comment yeah. on it. I have no idea. But, like, I do think that, like, we shouldn't ignore the ways that, like, this gives us insight and potential hint into, like, the way he performs and the way he acts.
No doubt. Guys, go out and get this book, Trash Talk, the only book about destroying your rivals that isn't total garbage. Rafi Cohen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys. A lot of fun.
Thank you.